Hello again, welcome back to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And this episode, we're going to do, I think, our first one in the Southern Hemisphere, if I'm not mistaken, with Russell King, albeit he's a Brit who relocated down there for love, as so many English people have done over the years. Anyway, he's worked on urban planning and transport policy in London as well as Sydney. He's not your natural transportation wonk. He's become a transportation wonk. But he's done work on some massive projects. He's helped deliver the Northern Line extension through things like smart value capture. He's kickstarted metro lines or been part of the development of new transit lines in New South Wales and played a really important role in integrating planning and transport policy in ways that lots of cities are still sort of struggling to figure out. This should be a really good episode for cities that are trying to figure that out. And we'll also get into what he wishes he knew 20 years ago, how we can think a bit differently about funding for these kinds of projects. And for a lot of it, it's why cities need to be getting on building and not just planning. So without further ado, here's a fantastic conversation all about how you build transport and influence policy with the wonderful Russell King. But Russell, thank you for so much for you're one of a collection of people that I'm I really like what they write on the internet. Must say hello and see if we can have a chat. And you're very gracious and you say yes. And you put
That's
loads
very
of great transport stuff out there.
That's very kind.
I'm
Thank you again
person.
For having me on. I mean, similarly, I've been enjoying your take on cities and transport around the world and some of the discussions we've had online about different aspects like autonomous vehicles and things in the future.
So this is going to be great. You're particularly interesting because you've done similar things in cultures that have overlap but are on opposite sides of the world. So I think it'd be lovely to get into some of your background around sort of public policy and transportation and a little potted history of your career to date.
Yeah. So I'll try and keep it brief as I can, but my original degree is biochemistry, so something completely different. And then, like many people in the UK, I ended up in financial services and doing project management and ICT and all sorts of things. But I was always a policy geek right the way from a very young wee lad. I've always been interested in public policy. And so inevitably, if you're interested in public policy, you tend to get involved in politics. And I did get involved in politics. And about 20 years ago, I found myself being elected as a councillor in London. In an inner London borough, the London Borough of Wandsworth. So for those of you who know London, Wandsworth has a famous landmark in there that's Battersea Power Station. It's also got Clapham Junction Station, which is one of the busiest stations in the world. There's a whole, so that sort of got me started as in sort of politics. And then I ended up becoming the cabinet member for strategic planning and transportation, which meant I did sort of policy around urban planning and also policy around transport. And at the time we had fantastic regeneration area, which is still being regenerated now, which is where Battersea Power Station is situated, which is the Nine Elms area. We worked as a council on getting alongside the landowners there, getting the Northern Line extension built, which opened up a couple of years ago, and getting that funded and delivered, which was a brilliant achievement. But I'd worked on a whole bunch of stuff there in terms of placemaking, in terms of parking, in terms of cycle policies, a whole range of different things that we were doing, and also around Pan-London policies as well, and movement and place and things like that, and helping out on those things. So that was my initiation into transport. And if you'd have asked me 20 years ago when I first started that 20 years later, you're going to be a transport geek, and I say that in a very, loving way, I would have gone, you're kidding. There's no way that's happening. And absolutely, I'm completely and utterly now a transport tragic and love the topic and love everything about it. And I look now back, in fact, I'm just my current blog, what I've done is I've kind of gone back to myself where I was 20 years ago, and I've written the blog on something, things I wish I knew 20 years ago when I started doing planning and transportation. Because there were so many things I just didn't understand. I didn't understand induced demand. If you'd have said to me, and most politicians do not, the understanding that you build another road or you add an extra lane and it's just going to come congested and make your city worse was not something I understood back then. I'd never even really heard of the concept. And so there's just a lot of transport stuff that's, is counterintuitive that you need to understand to really be able to make good transport decisions. And so I've kind of been on that journey. So I was a councillor for 8 years, and during that period I met a cute Australian girl who was living around the corner from me. We got engaged.
Obviously in that part of London.
Yes, as well. I lived in southwest London. There was a huge number of Australians living there, and she got an amazing job offer back in Australia. and we were engaged at that point. And she sort of said to me, what do you think? And I said, well, it's a once in a lifetime job offer. You've got to go and give it a try. And so she went and gave it a go. And after 3 months, we then eloped and went and got married in California, actually.
It's on the way.
And had a discussion about where we were going to live. And so the decision was made that we would move to Australia. So I gave up being a councillor and stood down at the next election and made my way over to Australia. And because I was obviously involved in politics and transport, I found myself helping out at an election for the New South Wales Liberal Party. And they got elected. And as a result, they said, Russell, please come and work with us. And I ended up finding myself as the policy director for the Minister for Transport and Infrastructure in New South Wales. Now, it was the perfect time because the New South Wales, the Liberal Party had gone into the election promising to what they call asset recycle, which was lease the infrastructure of the electricity grid. And that was going to deliver billions of dollars into the New South Wales Treasury, which they'd all pledged to spend on infrastructure. And most of that was transport infrastructure. There was also lots of schools and hospitals being built. But it basically meant that we were cashed up in transport to spend the money on improving the system. And we had lots of, in my case, particularly public transport projects that we wanted to get up. So we had 3 light rail projects we were building, one of which opened in Sydney, in George Street, one of the most famous streets in Sydney, and was a brilliant transformation of that street. Parramatta Light Rail, which opened up earlier this year in terms of phase one, there's a phase two as well. And I worked on both of those phases in the early days. And one in Newcastle Light Rail as well, which opened up a few years ago. And Newcastle is, this is Newcastle, New South Wales, which is
it's sunny,
200 kilometres north of Sydney. But, you know, we transformed that area as well with the light rail. And that looks like hopefully that'll get another extension sooner rather than later, because I think that will really add value as a network in that area. And then we had massive metro lines that we were building. So there was Metro Northwest, which opened, I think, 2019. City and Southwest, which opened last year and has been so well received. And there was, you know, and a brilliant transformation of the city. We've got the Southwest section of that will open, hopefully, towards the end of this year, maybe early next year. We also had the airport lines. There's a brand new airport being built in Sydney, out in Western Sydney. And we got the metro line for that started, and also another metro line out to Parramatta, which is really in the centre, geographical centre of Sydney, going from the central business district out there. And I kind of kicked off that project as well, and that'll open in the early 2030s. So that's kind of a whistle stop tour of all the stuff I worked on, and I was only in there for 2 years. You know, I was like, wow, look at all these things that we've kicked off that are, you know, are starting to be delivered. We did a number of other significant policy reforms as well. So this was the time when Uber was kicking off, and we did the reforms to enable Uber to operate legally, and did reform the whole taxi network, the point-to-point system in New South Wales. We did significant fare reforms as well, making the forms so the old fare system basically charged you twice if you changed modes. So if you went from ferry to light rail or light rail to bus, you had to pay twice. We were becoming more and more of an intermodal city where you were going to use more than one mode. And so it was important that we got rid of that. And so we rechanged the fare system to get rid of the network and basically make it very cheap to interchange.
So across all of that, like, it's a huge amount of building. It's a lot of like new stuff.
Yes.
And it's interesting, lots of people will point at London as this example of like, oh, they know how to build and run transit and blah, blah, blah. Mm. Basically, nobody in North America even thinks of Sydney, which I think is interesting, especially given like the vast amount of construction that's taken and is still taking place, which I think is really interesting. It all goes under the radar.
Yeah, I think Australia's a long way away from almost anywhere, partly, right? So we don't get out enough as a result, I think, and go and tell our story enough. I think there's a lot of good stuff that's been happening in Sydney, but it's not, but we're playing catch up. So prior to this age of investment in Sydney, there was a dearth of infrastructure for almost 2 decades, really, where we were just building virtually nothing. There was a kind of, well, Sydney is full, therefore don't build the infrastructure, even though the population was growing significantly. You know, it was not good policy, and certainly not good transport policy. So the city was becoming more and more congested. So there was a kind of a realization that we needed to invest more in public transport. And, you know, the government, as I say, was finding ways of funding that, which was then great. And we're still benefiting from that legacy. That one of the challenges we have is, you know, is that we're struggling for money moving forward now. And so the pipeline of projects is drying up. but we still, the city is still growing significantly, and we still have a lot of catching up to do in terms of public transport infrastructure. And we've got to invest more in buses. We need to continue building metro lines. We are massively underinvesting in active transport as well. So there's a whole bunch of stuff we still need to do a lot of, but unfortunately the money's running out at the moment, so we need to find new sources of funding.
Yeah. There's interesting things around how you fund. I'm sure this is in your Things I Wish I Knew 20 years ago package, but there's interesting things about how you fund transportation or any form of infrastructure, really, because a lot of the time the economists and the lawyers, when they do their projections of this is how many people will ride on this thing and this is how much it's going to cost us to build it, often the cost to build it is sandbagged, but then the ridership is often either greatly inflated or sandbagged itself. And then the things that end up getting built, by the time they open, you're like, hang on a minute, way more people are riding on this than we ever really imagined. We better start building another one, but where are we going to find the money from for it?
Yeah.
And I think it's like a really interesting challenge of, like, the Elizabeth line in London's a great example of, it's already massively blown its ridership projections out the window, but we spent years before building it debating, should we build it? And obviously,
And that's very typical of the UK. Like, if you look at most of the infrastructure projects in London over the last sort of 30 years, they were actually envisioned originally just after World War II. You know, it's just taken that long to debate and argue over them and get funding out of Her Majesty's Treasury to get things funded, etc. But I think you raise a really good point. So perhaps if I tell you the story of the Northern Line extension, it's a really great way of seeing how you can fund things in different ways. So I said the Northern Line extension is going through the Nine Elms regeneration area, which includes the Battersea Power Station. And when we were looking at the transformation of that area, one of the things that was a massive challenge was the lack of transport options. It was basically just one road in and out. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were doing is we were converting what was effectively a light industrial area into a residential area. And so the demand on the transport system was going to be significantly increased. And one of the things that was a problem was we couldn't allow density to go too high, too large, because of the restrictions in the transport infrastructure. And actually, it was the landowners who come to us and said, can we just get a Northern Line extension here? We'll put money in if you can, you know, through developers' contributions to fund it. One of the things here, I think, was mindset. It was very interesting, because I think a lot of places would have just gone, pie in the sky. You're asking for a whole train line extension. That's never going to happen, right? But actually, we were a very sort of forward-thinking and innovative council, and I knew very much about, understood the concept of value capture and how that worked as a concept. So what we did, we got some consultants to work up the numbers. Did it work? Did it stack up? If you increase the densities and capture the developers' contributions and looked at other alternative sources of funding, like uplift in the business rates that you would get from the community that's coming through, could you fund it? And the answer came back as, yes, you could, and pretty comfortably. Now, we were only a council. You know, we had a decent turnover, you know, at that time it was about over a billion pounds, but we didn't have the balance sheet to build a Northern Line extension. So really that was, and of course, we weren't in the business of building undergrounds. That was Transport for London. So Transport for London needed to be involved, but we were very lucky in that the mayor at the time was Boris, and his chief of staff was the former leader of Wandsworth Council. So we went and had a chat with, as I say, we, you know, it was done as a collective, as a council. When we had the conversation with Edward Lister, he completely got it and said, great idea, let's do this. We had the transport minister, the national transport minister was a Wandsworth MP as well. So she got it and understood what the challenge was. And so she was supportive. And so we basically ended up with a whole bunch of people who were all supportive, who could go to the treasurer and go, you're looking for good projects, here's a good one. And basically he agreed. And so we ended up with, you know, getting all the ducks aligned and getting the project up and running. You know, whereas normally London infrastructure takes about 3 decades to debate, this one got up relatively quickly, you know, and has been built and is very successful, and a credit to the army of people who have been involved over the decade or so that it took to go from sort of pie in the sky into actual delivery.
How did it work in terms of value capture? Because some of these things work through increase in business rates. Like the Parisian version is basically every employer pays a levy for transport,
which is the Elizabeth Line model. The Elizabeth Line was funded a lot through that. Yeah.
And the Northumberland line further north, that's more like the increase in the value of real estate, if I understand correctly. Like, how does it How did it work in the context of the Northern Line?
So the Northern Line extension, there were several sources of funding, but the value capture one around the developers' contributions was effectively there was going to be a significant increase in density enabled by having the Northern Line extension there. And so the developers were happy to have a significant contribution of the value they would get put towards the Northern Line extension project. Because they would still benefit by making more money because they're getting more property and more units they can provide. Okay, we're getting more housing, and we were very much a pro housing council at the time and wanted to deliver a lot of housing and recognizing the shortages of housing that we have in places like London. So it worked from that perspective, and it worked financially. So you know, it worked from many perspectives to get it up and running.
And then I think there's a really interesting thing of big transportation projects. People look at the cost that to go and create that project, but often people don't go and look at the value that it's going to provide over a period of time, because it's not about realizing the change on day one. It's more like, what will this mean for the area in 10, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, rail lines are city shaping.
The accretive value.
Yeah, rail lines are completely city shaping. And I think one of the failures we often see is a failure to integrate the transport and the land use around rail stations and rail lines. So one of the things I think we did well, you know, because we had an integrated urban planning and transport function within the council, the Nine Elms regeneration area did both at the same time and understood the benefits of doing both. In many jurisdictions, urban planning sits completely separately for transport. They're completely different disciplines, okay, and they don't like working together. And so you often see places where the transport is not supporting like the densification of an area, and the densification is taking place where there's no transport links. You know, it's really poor thinking, and you see it around the world, and it's because that tension between the two often exists. And you also then end up, if you then throw up Treasury's world view on things, it makes things worse. So if you're building a new rail line, you want to build a lot of stations along that rail line, because retrofitting stations is really expensive and difficult, etc. Okay, and these things are going to shape cities. And around those stations, you want to build lots of housing, mixed-use precincts these days, you know, childcare centres, markets, you know, shops, restaurants, etc. Turn them into real locations. Okay, and you want to do that, so you want to urban plan the two, urban and transport planning together. Okay, but what Treasury goes is they go, you need to reduce your budget on this line, therefore cut a station out. Yeah. And that's the wrong answer, because what they're looking at is the individual project on its own, when what they should be looking at is the whole of the transport and, quite frankly, the whole of the capital budget, and going, while we're building this thing, build more stations. That's much better long-term value for us. Okay, delay other projects, and reallocate the capital onto making sure you can deliver those stations while you're building this metro line. And that doesn't happen, because they're often looking very tunnel vision on a particular project, saying, you know, it was estimated to cost X billions of dollars. You know, it's gone over budget by, you know, Y number of dollars. Yeah, if we've got to cut back the number of stations in order to do it. And that's really, you know, short-term thinking that is very damaging.
There's a certain aspect of like magic that happens when doing these like infrastructure projects. So then it realizes previously unimagined behaviors. And it's like, you can't really quantify it. And like, if you put it into the model, people are like, but you've just made that up, mate. And you're like, yeah, I have made it up, but I have a hunch it might happen, but I can't prove it. But the only way you can prove it is by doing it. And I think it's like that's the interesting thing of how many journeys into London are not happening, or how many people are not living in this area because they physically can't, because there's only one road in and out of it. And that's where like the mindsets of, there's a little bit of vision versus but I need to see quantifiable proof.
Yeah, and it's often the design of the project that's problematic as well in terms of the estimates and things. So you often see projects, I've seen projects where, you know, light rail projects, for example, where it's going to the wrong places, or it's going along the wrong route, okay? It's not going where the demand already is. You know, you're often in those places, you know where the demand already is, but it's too difficult to retrofit in there. Therefore, they go to somewhere else where it's not got the demand. And then the numbers are overestimated, okay? And then it's kind of a failure of a project. So you've got that sort of problem. You then have the gaming of the system, whereas, you know, we just want to get any project up, therefore we'll overestimate the number of people, right? And so, it does end up with huge amounts of gaming, and there are, you know, there's a whole bunch of studies around, you know, what you should be doing in order to understand the costs and the the estimates here. And one of the things I think that transport agencies are not great at is actually benchmarking their projects globally and going, are our costs really genuine compared to similar or equivalent projects elsewhere? Yeah. If our project is estimated to be 30% cheaper, why? Is that really justified? Now, sometimes that is. So there are some fantastic examples. Madrid is a really great example of how it's done some fantastic thinking about dramatically reducing costs. I mean, we are talking compared to Sydney. It's been building its metro lines at almost a tenth of the cost.
Have you been on the Madrid metro?
I have. Yes, I have when I was in Madrid, but not recently.
I've been on it a couple of times. Changing between lines is awful. There's times when you get to a station like, where the hell am I going? And there's times when you look at the map and you're like, why is it to go from this quite prominent place to go to that quite prominent place requires like three different, I have to change trains twice to get there or take a really circuitous route to only have one change. And like, I was talking to somebody in Madrid and they were like, we had the choice of build the thing that doesn't quite work, but lots of people will put up with and use it, or have nothing. And we made the choice of have the thing that doesn't quite work, but lots of like, people just go, well, it is what it is and I'll use it. And I find it as a fascinating example because they built so much so cheaply, but it's not quite right.
Yeah, and I think there's also this debate around high-speed rail. So there's the Bright Line in Florida, which is high-speed rail, inverted commas, right, which is a private sector thing. And what they've done to make the numbers work, they've made a lot of compromises, okay, to make it financially viable for them, right? If the private sector is doing that, that's what they'll do. If it's the public sector, and so it's somebody else's money, they'll be like, it'll be gold standard, right? Yeah. You know, and everything will work really well. But typically, it will be massively expensive to build, and it'll need a huge subsidy every year in order to be
CHS2,
which is a basket case. But there's other examples, right? California's trying to build a high speed rail, which is just a money pit at the moment, as far as I think everyone can see. Australia doesn't have a high speed rail yet, and there's a lot of high-speed rail envy. Well, why haven't we got high-speed rail? Everybody else has got high-speed rail. We should have it. And I think if Australia's kind of cities are very far apart, typically. So they've got Canberra, which is kind of the capital, but it's an artificial city set up for basically the political side of the country. But its population is only a few hundred thousand. And although it's a kind of, 250-300 kilometres from Sydney, so it's a perfect place for high-speed rail. And if Melbourne was where Canberra is, right, instead of being 1,000 kilometres from Sydney, we would have high-speed rail between the two points, right? Because you'd have two very significant population areas. High-speed rail would be a brilliant solution, quicker than the airport and all of the hassle of doing that. It would be very frequently used. People would commute between the two. It would be a no-brainer. But Melbourne and Sydney, the two biggest cities, are 1,000 kilometres apart. You know, even on high-speed rail,
it's just too far.
It's just a bit too far, and it's very, very expensive. Yeah. So even when they did the last high-speed rail, which was connecting, I think, Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne, it was estimated at just over $100 billion. That was a decade ago, and it'll probably be now closer to $200 billion. And that's without the operating costs as well. And in Australia, public transport is very, very heavily subsidised. Typically, 75% plus is government subsidy. So when you go on your operating costs, one of the things I think London has done extremely well is minimizing its subsidy. So it basically covers its operating costs now. Not quite its capital costs, but it does that while still having fantastic coverage across the city, okay? And also having options for people who are on lower incomes and enabling them to have cheap transport options as well. So it does a really good balancing act between the different sort of financial pressures. Whereas what you're finding in America at the moment, for example, they're all relying on federal subsidies. The federal subsidies are now drying up and they're all like, we're going to have to massively reduce our services in order to cover it. And I think we've been making public transport can be funded without, and there are lots of examples around the world, not just in London, where they do make it work without huge amounts of subsidies.
It's interesting. I learned this the other day, but in Canada, every time you ride the train between Toronto and Montreal, the government is effectively subsidising it to the tune of $60 or $70. And your train ticket probably costs $100. So it's sort of fascinating. And that's the bit that's actually that's the bit that makes more money. And it's too far. It's too far and too slow for the distance. So that's why they want to do high-speed rail here. But I'm going to be really fascinated when they come out with the the business case for it, because they were going to rely on a lot of people traveling who don't travel right now, a lot of people changing from the train, a lot of people changing from the car. But will they be trying to charge $250 a ticket, or will they be trying to charge $100 a ticket? Because it's interesting. And then does that take into account the economic benefit of people traveling who don't travel today? And it's messy because nobody thinks of the roads being subsidized, but they are. So I think it's fascinating to sort of how do you make the maths work?
Yeah, it's very difficult because people like the reason the car model works is people pay a big lump sum up front, right?
Yeah.
And then don't worry about the incremental costs so much. Fuel costs a little bit, but they don't think about the total cost of ownership. Whereas every time you get on a train, typically, you're paying a fare, so you feel it at that pain at that point.
Yeah.
All right. And so it's a different sort of psychological dynamic. So even if your costs are much lower on public transport, you feel the pain of paying on public transport much more, and people are much more sensitive to fares, which is an inherent challenge constantly on, you know, encouraging people to use public transport as opposed to the motor vehicle.
Yeah. And driving a car, I think. Like the UK, you have road tax. In Canada, you pay the gas tax. But that doesn't cover anywhere near the cost of the various tiers of government having a road. And I think it's lots of people think the road is free.
I mean, so the guru on parking, Donald Shoup, who passed away earlier this year, you know, he worked out the value of the parking subsidies that take place.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically said that's worth more than all the roads. It's just the parking subsidy is just huge, right? Because it's just huge amounts of land being used for free parking, you know, which could be used for much more productive uses, you know. And not only that, the parking then encourages car use, which makes congestion even worse, right? So he was a big advocate for managing parking much more proactively and pricing it properly. You'd reduce congestion, you'd reduce the wasted land use. And then if you put the proceeds into improvements in local communities, whether that's walking and cycling infrastructure or creating great places, you know, in city centres and shopping centres where, you know, public art and all the rest of it, if people feel that their place is improving, then they're actually happy to pay for those for parking rather than just have everything free.
I find it interesting, having moved to Quebec, in Ontario, they removed the license fee tax. Quebec still has it. But if you live in the city of Montreal, there's an extra license fee tax that then subsidizes public transport. And I think a lot of people really hate it. And at first you feel a bit stung by it. And I have my suspicions of, do they use the money very well?
Mm.
But actually communicating those really clearly, like to pay for your parking, I think I should be charged a bit more to pay for the parking. And if you make those things all add up, like, I would actually, like, my car probably moves once a week, twice a week if it's parked on the wrong side of the road for street cleaning. But, like, there's this I would quite happily get rid of my car if there were better car shares. But a lot of the time there's not better car share options because there isn't the demand for it, because people have the ability to store their car outside for free. And connecting those dots, I think, is, like, the car share is not very sexy right now. But, like, 5-10 years ago, BMW had their sort of drive now thing, the car was kind of big, but like car shares should be a more attractive proposition. So you have the carrot of, all right, I can't store my crap in it and I've got to take my rubbish out when I get home, but at the same time I don't have to deal with any of the hassle of my own car. And I think like that's where the cities thing gets all messy, because people like to be a bit dogmatic about transit, but at the same time, like, I want a car occasionally, but I don't necessarily need my own. And making that all come together and work so you know what you're paying for, what you're subsidising.
Yeah.
Could make that. If you do that better for cars, you make a better argument for trains.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Just going back to the parking one, in Sydney, a couple of the areas have got what they call a parking space levy, which is paid for by the owners of the car parking spaces. So if you own a commercial building, an office building in the city, you know, with a few basements of parking in it, you pay per space on that. And that money then gets dedicated towards public and active transport. So the light rail that I talked about going down George Street, one of the sources for funding for that was the parking space levy within the city. So it's another way of funding public transport, is through things like that. And what that also has done is that parking space levy has created incentives to reduce the amount of parking and in the city and encourage people to use public transport. And the city is the place that is, you know, best, you know, most of the public transport is focused around the CBD, probably far too much, if anything, because we're not very good at connecting places that aren't, you know, you have to go through the CBD almost for everything.
Yeah. So we're not, the thing I'm curious about, to bring it back to sort of the work you've done in Australia, is you go through this like, glut of building projects. And one of the problems the Anglosphere has is that public sector has been hollowed out in terms of competency to understand how to build those projects. So I'm kind of imagining that now Australia's or New South Wales has built a load of competency to go build things, but if it hasn't got the pipeline of new things, what happens to the people who've... It's kind of like learning how to play cricket and then somebody saying, well, then there's not going to be as many matches that you can play in, I guess.
It's a great thing. And I think the French have been brilliant at this. Well, in France, they had the Olympics, of course. They were building loads of metro lines for Paris to try and open them in time for the Olympics and all the rest of it. And they built a very highly competent sort of state-owned corporation, effectively, that did a brilliant job of building the metros. And they had all this competency. And of course, they're no longer going to need metros in Paris now, right? But what they've realised is they wanted to build a whole bunch of regional rail projects connecting people, you know, basically connecting their regional towns with it across France. And they've got a huge amount of package. And so what they've done is they just repurposed that organisation and that capability. So instead of building metro lines now, it's now building railways regionally. And I think that's a fantastic way of that they have developed and used that capability that they had built and found a way of continuing it. I think in many jurisdictions, yeah, you see it kind of, they build up a capability, which is very expensive. They use it for one project and then you lose it again. And I suspect that if we had, I haven't looked at it in deep detail, but I suspect if you play to a place like China, that's gone very, very big on high speed rail. And I suspect there's a lot of projects there that really don't probably make sense, but you know, they're big on spending infrastructure to justify it, right? But I suspect they've built up a really great capability that they're just using to make it more and more efficient to build high-speed rail. So it's not, you know, the costs, and I think one of the challenges you'll have in Canada is, you know, if you build a high-speed rail, is where's the capability and competency for high-speed rail right now when it's the first one off the piece? So you're going to have to kind of get people in externally who've got expertise in this, right? And, you know, in order to build that capacity and capability and deliver it successfully if it gets up.
It's what the French and the Chinese have also done really well, is like France will, you find random French groups of folks that like used to live in Paris but are now building trains in like Dakar or Riyadh because they've exported the French model and system. And it's like, well, we don't have projects at home, we can at least go and like sell, this becomes like a national export. And I guess it was true for the Germans because that's what they were doing with China, and then China just nicked all the technology and now they're selling it back to places that want high-speed trains. But then there's also the export model, I guess.
Yeah, and like the Australia's incorporated and sort of huge amounts of Brits have come over to help build rail lines. I think one of the things we've made mistakes on is perhaps being too Anglosphere oriented in terms of our models for this. And I think it would have been smart to have a more diverse base. You know, I know some very talented Europeans, assuming at least European Union citizens, I should say these days, who brilliant capability, etc., and understand different ways of doing these things, often significantly better, quite frankly, than, you know, that they've been building them in the UK. I mean, you know, let's be honest about it. The US has got lots of projects that have failed miserably. The UK's got projects that have, you know, it's done an Elizabeth line, but it was very late and very expensive. Yeah. High speed two, well, enough said, right? Whereas there's Paris has built light rail projects very cheap. You know, France has built light rail projects very cheaply. It did very well on its metro in Paris. Madrid's done really well in Spain. So, you know, there are lots of good examples around the world who do things a lot better than a lot of the Anglosphere countries have been doing in recent years.
There's a really interesting thing I find for like the, I think the UK is amazing for transport marketing. So it's like, how do you do the, the UK is kind of terrible for transport engineering compared to other places.
Yeah.
But if you go to Germany, a lot of the time you can't pay with a card on a bus. They'll send you with cash to a ticket machine. Like, I know other people have ranted, and like John Sills, who runs like a human behavior consultancy, rages when he goes to Paris with the kids because like you can't really buy the tickets properly to go to the airport, and they haven't nailed the customer experience going through the gates. And I think that's really, really, I think that's really interesting. Of broadly, I think the Brits are actually really good at like taking a bus route that isn't ideal, but painting the bus in a different livery or putting along the side of the bus of this bus will stop at these places. Whereas if you go to a lot of other places, you look at it, it'll just say the end destination of the bus. And it's like, I live here and I don't know where that is. Nor do I have a clue where it stops on the way there. I think there's a really interesting thing of like, one nation doesn't.
A couple of thoughts on that. I remember when I was interviewing with the Minister for Transport and Infrastructure, one of the questions they asked was like, we're thinking of making the light rail pink. What do you think? Okay. And I actually said, Well, it's an interesting idea. It depends on what you want to achieve, right? Because if you're trying to do like a global branding, black cabs, red buses, yellow taxis, etc., it can actually be really effective as a sort of marketing strategy for a place. So I didn't rubbish the idea or anything. But apparently almost everybody else they interviewed had rubbished the idea and just sort of laughed it out of the place. But the reason they were asking the question, not because necessarily they were thinking about making it pink, but they were, are you open to ideas? And are you open to new thinking? So I kind of... In terms of one of the things I think Sydney did really, really well during sort of was it switched to focusing much more on the customer in terms of its transport. And I know a lot of transport agencies have really struggled with this. It's full of, you know, engineers and technicians who don't naturally think about the customer as the delivery. They're very much into the engineering aspects of it. And one of the things we did was look at all of these things. We put in new wayfinding. The wayfinding in Sydney used to be terrible. It's dramatically improved over the last decade or so. We bring in a new ticketing system, the Opal card. So it's very much copying sort of the London model. And that's transformed it as well, made it much easier for people to get around the system. So I completely agree with you that sort of aspect is often neglected. And, you know, you can see how a big, large transport agency, it's prioritizing, you know, are we investing in new services or are we investing in making sure that people can get through their ticket barriers kind of easily and those sorts of things. Those things can often just fall off the radar for the engineers and never gets a priority call.
Yeah, it's also things as basic, I think TfL... They almost sort of take it for granted, but like foreigners will go and buy TfL merchandise to take home and decorate their homes with it.
Mm.
Like the tube has become like a design icon in some ways by design, in some ways actually by accident.
Yes.
But then you look at places that have developed their transit systems later and you kind of struggle to think of many, like, are there any really iconic sort of, other than transport wonks, are there really iconic transit systems that people would put their stuff up as art?
Yeah.
I mean, there are some, but there's not many.
No, and I think it goes back to the original DNA of the London Underground and how it was originally built. So if you look, the art sort of stuff starts when the original Metropolitan Line was built. So there's like posters you can buy of, because it was built by the private sector. It was basically a land project, right? A development project. So basically people had loads of land out in, what was it, northwest London, okay?
Buckinghamshire and that kind of area.
This
right?
is like Middlesex, that kind of area.
Or Middlesex.
Right? Yeah. Sort of, and so the Metropolitan Line was built basically to provide access for the people that they were going to build houses for to be able to get into the city for their jobs, right? Yeah,
Metro land, was that?
Yeah, okay. And that was how it was created. Right. So it was basically a complete, you know, developer's land use play. But one of the things they wanted to do was they encouraged people to use the transport system. And so they did, like, you had lots of advertising campaigns, you know, have a day trip at the weekend, you know, into the city or whatever. And they created brilliant art to promote it as part of their marketing thing. So it kind of started right from the beginning of the Metropolitan Line. And so it's kind of been built into the DNA of the whole transport, you know, London Underground system right from the start. And I think that's just continued over the decades. I mean, even the map itself has been is iconic, right? And the design of the map, you know, the genius of sort of the blue bar with the red lines around it, you know, it's just, it is fantastic.
I thought when they did the Elizabeth line, having that almost pulled out as its own separate mode was going to be a dumb move. It didn't make sense to me, but like now that the thing works, it's like, yeah, that really does make sense, having it as its own purple thing on the map, and it's not just another tube line or just another overground kind of light line. So I thought that was like really clever.
Mm-hmm.
But they, I think they got like a lot of criticism for that. But it's like, hang on, just trust us. They've been proven right. So it's really interesting the way those things work and the way that... I actually have a friend who sells... When buses and trains get decommissioned, he buys like the leftover rolls of like the moquette, like the seat cushioning.
Yes.
And turns it into like cushions and pencil cases and bookmarks and whatnot. And I think it's like such a smart, niche, little nerdy business. And it turns over a decent amount. But like, there's not many, you can't look at many other places around the world and go, oh, I really want like a Toronto Transit Commission bit of branding in my house.
No. I mean, one of the things though I would say is there are places that are thinking much better about public art. So one of the things we did when I was in the minister's office, actually, it was a conscious decision. Historically, Sydney's transport infrastructure was very functional and often really poorly sort of designed in terms of creating a nice place to be at. to be and dwell. And one of the things we did with the new metro line was to significantly improve the design and the architecture and incorporate public art across the public transport network. And that's one of the reasons that people have gone wow on the new metro line when it opened last year, was just there's just public art in all of the major stations on there. They're really well designed. They feel like great places to be. Okay. Mm-hmm. People just went, the whole product was just fantastic. You know, and so patronage numbers have been fantastic, and they're probably going to have to start looking at buying new rolling stock to be able to run more trains, which is fine because the trains at peak time are currently run at every four minutes, but there was always the capacity to double that within the system as long as you bought the rolling stock.
Yeah. And in terms of like growing these things or running these things over time, I think there's a sort of frustration that some people see of working in transit isn't necessarily a desirable job. So like you didn't set out wanting to do this. You sort of like fell into it. But I think there's almost this, you don't see a lot of entrepreneurship or creativity come by. A lot of it comes by sort of accident of people who've stumbled into it and have to find creative solutions to problems. It's still not a particularly desirable sector for a lot of people to work in. And it still has a bit of a culture of like, oh, I've been here a while, get out of my way. I think there's a cultural problem in terms of making more use of the transit that we have and improving what we have, rather than the conversation always being about building new stuff.
Yeah, I think we have cultural challenges in transport, as you say. You know, a lot of our transport organisations have become very bureaucratic. And very siloed. So you get sort of big silos between, say, different modes, buses versus rail or versus active transport, or people who build infrastructure versus the strategic planners and the policymakers or whatever. So you end up with those challenges. But what that does is, as an organization, is it kind of creates lots of veto points because everybody has to try and agree on things. And that just kills innovation, right? Because every time, and they're also, like much of the public sector, very hierarchical structures. So if you've got to go, you know, to get it up to somebody who can make a decision, it's got to go through like 8 single, you know, signatures and sign-offs. That's effectively 8 veto points. And that's just in one silo. You've got the silo next door who also has to agree, and they've got to go through similarly 8 signatures. And so you suddenly have like 16, you know, veto points on any innovation that needs to take place within the transport agency. And the result is no innovation takes place. Okay. And it's basically, plus you've got a whole lobby within there that's always been building roads, okay? And so they're always like, what's our next road to build, please? All right? Whereas the answer in often for the city is like, we shouldn't be building any more roads, or, you know, we should be dramatically reducing the amount of roads and upgrades that we should be doing and putting that money into walking and cycling and public transport and new bus services, etc. I mean, the billions we spend on roads could deliver so much extra, you know, bus infrastructure and active transport infrastructure, which would be far more beneficial from a transport perspective, let alone health or the environmental perspective. You know, cultural legacy in transport agencies is very difficult to tackle unless you're very determined.
I got brought in to talk to a sort of Minister of Transport for a Canadian province years ago, and we had the meeting and it didn't go, I don't think, where we thought it was going to go or he thought it was going to go. And at the end, the aide afterwards was like, you kind of missed the mark there, because we might be the Ministry of Transport, but we're really the Ministry of Trucking. Yes. And it was sort of like this, oh yeah, that's, I can see now. But like the idea of like buses were an inconvenience to the trucks, and even cars were like tolerated, but it was really like, we designed these roads to get trucks from here to here.
Yes.
It wasn't the mindset of moving people.
And this is, and I feel really sympathy for, you know, having been a politician and sort of not knowing anything about transport, I feel real sympathy for this. So I've done a whole bunch of stuff on how do we help our politicians become better transport ministers, you know, because they're like the average member of the public, right? So if you ask the average member of the public, you know, your road is congested, what do? Build an extra lane. That will be the answer for most people, right? Because it sounds intuitive, you know. We've got too many cars, you know, for the size of the road, make the road bigger. It doesn't work because of, you know, in something called induced demand, but, you know, it's an intuitive answer. And most politicians aren't interested in transport policy when they go into politics. You know, they're interested in all sorts of other value stuff, but transport is one of the things that they're very rarely, you know, transport geeks in. And so they don't really understand it. And one of the things we're really poor at is when they become the transport minister or a shadow transport minister, is sitting down and explaining to them the realities of transport and what things actually happen. So I never had this, right? It would have been great if somebody had sat me down and just said, look, here's the things we need to explain to you, okay, about how transport works, right? But no one did that. And partly that's because in a lot of ways, our public service has become worried about sort of providing advice, right? Because we've ended up sort of creating a culture where we kind of shoot them down on some of these things. And, you know, they're not angels, public servants, by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, they're doing a really tough job. And one of the things you need to do when you're in a minister's office is you need to build relationships with them so they feel that they can come to you with their concerns on things and be honest with you, even if they disagree with you, right? And so that's a really important aspect of this. But of course, people come in and go, right, we're going to build, you know, roads agenda. And you're like, well, you haven't really thought through this from a transport perspective, okay, and how this is going to work. And you see that all the time. New ministers come in, you know, the road lobby gets in there, and often it's the road lobby from within the transport agency, by the way, right? Build a road. This will help, you know, solve congestion. The transport planners and the transport strategists who understand induced demand are all sort of holding their heads in their hands, okay? And then over time, what happens is the minister realizes that this is the case, but by the time they've sort of realized the induced demand problem and had explained to them, they've moved on, and you've got the new minister in who you're starting from scratch again. And so you end up with that sort of vicious cycle of never quite ending the system. And this is where city governance comes in. You know, cities kind of are much, you know, a lot of cities now are much more proactive in terms of knowing that investing in active and public transport is the way forward for their cities. And so you're seeing mayors, whether it's in places like London, Paris, are doing much more transformative stuff because of their governance model. It's more challenging in areas where, you know, the governance model is kind of balanced between, say, city and state.
Yeah.
Okay. And the state has to do roads for the regional areas, and it can't quite get its head round. It needs different answers in the cities to what it does in the regional areas.
This is Toronto and Ontario with bike lanes. It's like the province wants rid of bike lanes, but the city wants it. But the province's electoral base all comes from the suburbs who also hate bike lanes. So it's like, it's messy.
Yes. And to be honest with you, we struggle with the same thing in Sydney, right? We've got councils, small councils within the city who majority of them are proactive transport. The state government is kind of talks a game on active transport, but the money doesn't actually flow into it. And the politics, yeah. And partly that's because the politics are difficult.
I want to ask you a question around like delivering some of this in a public policy perspective, because I'm really interested in Liz Truss at the moment, because I think she's a dangerous and dark force in our world again.
Okay.
But like, you will find her at basically every sort of right-wing economic or political conference talking about the deep state and how it stopped her pushing her agenda. And it was actually that meant that her premiership was quickly terminated. And like, if you took the other end of the Conservative Party in the UK, you get like a Rory Stewart talking about how every single MP for Cumbria talks about dueling the A66. And it's 30 odd years later and it's never been done, even though it's been promised. There's a huge thing of like, people look at all this bureaucracy's bloated, it doesn't do anything. You've actually got former prime ministers now poking at it, not just sort of like angry vox pops of voters. Is that like a real inhibitor? Is that like a real problem? How do you work with that? Because you've clearly done things where you've got quite difficult projects done in a relatively expedient period of time. I'm curious if you've got any, this is maybe asking too difficult a question, but I'm curious if you've got any sort of thought about that.
So it's not just a transport issue. It's across all disciplines. You're seeing this problem in the public service, health, education, social services, treasury, etc. And it's a global problem, certainly in the Westminster style, but you're really seeing it across the board. You're seeing it in places like other countries as well that are outside of the Anglosphere. It's one of the things that I'm really I can see the symptoms, and I can see the underlying causes. What I haven't quite worked out a solution. Here's a kind of my take on it. So problem number one is building the capability and capacity of the public service or the civil service is not really anyone's responsibility at the moment, right? So if you're politicians and you're like, I need to build the capacity and capability of the public service over the next decade. Well, ministers are kind of looking at what they can do in the next 2 years before they're shuffled around, right? So it's just not on their agenda. It's not on Prime Minister's agenda at all. You know, they're dealing with a 24/7 news cycle, right? It's a nightmare for them. This thing doesn't that. So that they're not concerned about that. At the same time, what we've done is the leadership of the civil services and the public services have become much more short-term tenure and much more politically appointed, okay? And as a consequence, their investment in protecting the civil services' capability and capacity has reduced because they're now serving their political masters on a political timetable, which is in a short-time horizon, Okay. And they're appointed to do that. So you've lost those people who are thinking about the capacity and capability of the organizations. So that's problem number one that you've got. Second thing is most of these bureaucracies are basically organizations like from the 1960s, right? So they're still very hierarchical. They're still very siloed. You know, their mentality is not the sort of flexible modern corporations that you see. They're still very bureaucratic. And what happens is if you're doing that, it makes them become very fat and as a result. So you end up with, you know, very large numbers of bureaucrats to do quite basic things, quite frankly. Okay. Now, the other thing you then have is if you're a really talented person and you come into one of these organizations, you very quickly become frustrated by the red tape and the bureaucracy. And what you do is if you've got alternatives, like I can go and be, you know, a world leading consultant in my particular, whatever my niche is, and I can earn a lot more money and I have a lot less red tape to deal with. That's what they go and do. So you lose the talented people from the government agencies because they can achieve a lot more with a lot less stress and a lot more money elsewhere. And so you lose a lot of the talent as well. So you've got a problem of recruiting and retaining talent. No one cares about this issue as well. No one's sort of accountable for this issue because by the time they start off dealing with the capacity and capability issue, they'll have been gone, right? Yeah. And so you end up with that challenge essentially there. Then you add on the political side of things. So what typically happens is treasurer wants money savings, okay, but doesn't want to pay for redundancies, right? So what they'll do is they'll do it through natural attrition. So you never get rid of the people who can't get jobs elsewhere that you need to be moving out of the organization. The people that leave are the ones that have got talent and are good.
Yeah.
You're losing all your talent through that process. It's nice and cheap for the politicians, okay, and for the government finances, but in terms of capacity and capability moving forward, it's a disaster, right? The other thing is you can get around it. You can bypass it, but it's only for short term. So what typically happens is you then, if you want to be really good at something, okay, you build a new function for it, okay, right? So you take it away from the mothership that's a nightmare and you create a sort of separate agency that specializes in doing this thing. And often it builds up a really great capacity and capability in it. Okay? And that minister that was really passionate about that protects it, defends it, you know, and makes sure it delivers. And it delivers really high quality people. So an example in the UK was the former foreign aid agency.
DFID, right?
Globally recognised as a centre of excellence for what it did. Brilliant in terms of what it did. New minister comes in, or change of prime minister, whatever, you know, and it loses its champion. And then what happens is the bigger agencies take a nibble at it and go, well, if you brought it into our agency, we'd maybe be able to make it more efficient. Okay, we could now share our HR services, share our ICT systems. They don't need to do their own procurement, all these sorts of things. And so they bring it into the mothership and it loses everything that was good about it. Okay, mm-hmm. As a result. And you see this happening time and time again in the sort of efficiency, because the mothership never gets sorted because it's a complete basket case. And if you're a sensible minister and you want to get stuff done, you take it away from the mothership in order to get stuff delivered. Okay, but it's a short-term fix, it's a band-aid only. And meanwhile, the capability and competency of the public service in general is continuing to decline. That's a real problem. And there are different levels, you know, across different jurisdictions on where they are on the curve of decline, but many of them are, if not all of them, are heading in that same direction. Sorry, that was a very long explanation and well outside the transport remit, but I hope that...
I was deliberately pushing you away from the transport remit because I think like it's a really important thing that ties a lot of what I'm trying to have a conversation about across this whole series together. Is challenges we have around transport are often common challenges we have around housing, are often common challenges we have around climate.
Yes.
And a lot of people kind of bitch and moan a little bit about the sort of same things without necessarily understanding the why or getting to the solution. I think you really understand the why, even if you're still working on the solution. So I kind of deliberately sort of railroaded you in that direction because I knew you might go there, and it's good. That's where I wanted to sort of come to.
It is a real challenge about how we deal with this. I mean, I know that a couple of people have looked at like their agencies and stuff and gone, I can actually do this with about a third of the people that are here. And what I'd like to be able to do is get rid of two thirds or so of people, bring in another extra 10%. Okay, so I'm still making them like 60% saving, okay, across the agency. And I think I could deliver more and more effectively, right? But that sort of radical change is very rarely going to be given support. You're going to have a lot of pushback on that sort of thing, because if one agency did that and did it successfully, it becomes a template for everywhere else. And you can imagine like the resistance you're going to get to doing that. That would be a very, very interesting experiment, and I think there's a lot of logic in that.
I'm really interested in less so cities, but also I'm quite interested in like provinces and states. So I think Estonia is always like the poster child of this, of like digital government. But they kind of did it because they didn't actually have digital government came along because they didn't really know how they were going to get people to pay their taxes, and they had to get off the Russian system and develop a new system. So it was like, we don't have a lot of resources. There's this new internet thing. Let's give that a go, and it kind of worked out. But I look at like provinces in Canada, whether it's like a New Brunswick, which is basically skint and demographically in trouble, and go, you can keep going the way you're going, or you can try the dramatic thing. And actually there aren't that many people here, so how many people are you really going to impact? And then if you get that to work there, then an Alberta or a Quebec or an Ontario go, you could do that, and now we don't feel so scared doing it because somebody else did it. And so they become like the challenger. But I think you kind of need to find a place that's like the tier two, tier three, slightly like on the precipice of something bad happening, and then go, where's the pump, folks? I think that might be the way around it.
I think one of the things that America does really well is that ability to sort of try, but effectively have more than like 50 experiments at state level.
Yeah.
And even below that, hundreds of experiments, you know, at its democratic level below that, in terms of trying new things and, you know, learning from each other and sort of copying great ideas that work. I think that's a real strength of the US system. And I think it's a weakness in the UK in particular, which is very, very centralized. Its ability to innovate is dramatically held back by the London-centric Westminster bureaucracy. And a lot of the innovation could take place if there was a lot more local flexibility.
Yeah. Well, I think like Wales is an interesting little...
Yeah, Wales
does under the radar sandbox.
Work on the transport stuff as well. It went big on, you know, not to building roads and really looking at, you know, active transport and public transport and dramatically changing its thinking around transport. And that was quite a transformational change. It's starting to row back a little bit because the minister who was responsible for that moved on, and I think they felt it was politically challenging to continue down that path. Yeah. They didn't completely reverse by any stretch of the imagination, but it's kind of like two steps forward, one step back kind of thing.
I think Scotland has a similar thing of like a lot of the things they've done sounded nice, but then in practice just haven't worked. So it makes them scared to go and try something else sometimes.
Yeah, I think both in Scotland's and Wales's cases, their public policy results are mixed at best.
Yeah.
So you're seeing really poor outcomes in terms of education and health, where I think there has been a kind of ideological bent towards their policy rather than a pragmatic, how do we improve outcomes bent.
And delivered by the B team.
Yeah, and delivered by the B team, arguably, as well. But I think you could, if you were heading in the right direction, I think you could recruit the A team. Because the people who are the A team are frustrated often by not being able to deliver A-grade results from their existing organisations. I think if you set out a dynamic vision for an area that can attract the talented people, they'll come and do it, right? Transport people are a great example, right? If you're doing stuff interesting in the transport space, they'll come and work for you. They'll take pay cuts. They'll, you know, they'll work in worse conditions because they believe, you know, and are passionate about what they do. And they'll come and do it if they believe that you're going to deliver. Right. What they're not going to do though is you're going to like, well, you know, we'll put 1% of our budget into active transport. Well, you're not going to attract the cycling and the, you know, the active transport, you know, experts and people who are, you know, our top draw in this space. Whereas if you're saying we're going to put 20% of our budget into it, which I think Ireland has pledged to do, you know, and other jurisdictions are doing, then people are going to go, wow, they're serious about the transformation. They're going to really back this. We'll go for it.
So I like to end these things on like, you've been amazing at like lots of lived experience, lots of grounded in realities. If I gave you a magic wand though, then you don't have to be so realistic. What would you do with it? Where would you put the priority? What would your wish or command be basically?
This is unrealistic, but given it's a magic wand, I'll go with it. And this perhaps is my particular bent. I'm a public policy geek, right? I'm a big believer in good policy. And one of my sayings and the sayings we had in the minister's office was, you know, what's the right policy? So we're trying to work out what good policy looks like, and then how do we make the politics work? And if I could wave a magic wand, I would effectively upgrade all of our politicians to trying to understand what good policy is and trying to find the right political answers. So I think the best transformative politicians we've ever had, that was always their mindset. Their mindset was very much, what's the right policy? How can I get the politics to work to achieve these things? I think that... For a whole combination of reasons, the number of politicians we have who are of that mindset has dramatically reduced. And that's one of the reasons that our policies have become, you know, have declined, and why a lot of our communities are very frustrated by the lack of progress. And you're seeing, therefore, rises of populist politicians, whether on the left or the right, because we don't have the politicians who are in the centre-left, centre-right, centre-ground, etc., who are delivering for them, partly because of the pressures they're under from the 24-hour media cycle and the pressures that's put on them and their families and all the rest of it. And we've also, but we've also made being a politician a really rubbish job. And when it's one of the ones you want to run your country, you don't want it to be a rubbish job. Okay, you want to be attracting the cream. And the fact is, you know, I know I've met so many talented people over the years, you know, who I've thought, wow, it would be great to have you, you know, leading a government, you know, or leading departments or et cetera, who would never dream of it because they're earning several times more money and with a lot less stress. Okay, why would they become a politician, even if they're interested in politics? And so I think my magic wand would be to sort of fix that problem at the top in terms of the politicians we get.
I think that is a completely and utterly delusional use of your magic wand, and also one that should actually be like, why can't we do this? So that's exactly the type of response I like to get from these things, because you know what? You're mental, but that's not totally crazy.
There is a logic for why it's the right thing to do, right? And it's kind of like, it's not so fantastical, right? That you're like, I've completely changed the universe, you know, and now no longer here, you know, but it does go to an underlying problem that we have that is very, very difficult to fix.
Yeah. I find it fascinating when you read, I'm a big fan of like The Rest is History. And I don't, if you ever like read Dominic Sandbrook's enormous books on Britain in the 60s and 70s, it's like reading into a different world of what a politician or a minister was like back then versus what one's like today.
Yes. He put out one on Twitter this week, Dominic did. I think it was a survey of teenagers and the people they most respected during the 1960s. Okay. And I was expecting like the Beatles to be top. You know, and the Rolling Stones like to be
Barbara
like
Castle or something.
Things. It was like the Prime Minister was in the top 10. You know, I was like completely and utterly gobsmacked. I'm like, what? There's no way a teenager these days would have that in there. So it was a very, very different time. And you know, that genie is out of the bottle. But we now need to think about how we create a better sort of civic society moving forward. And that's a very, very difficult.
I think it's difficult, but I think it's doable. I think that I give confidence in the next generation. So anyway,
I think that's a very good mindset to have, to be positive about how, you know, my kids, I've got three young kids, right? I'm hoping that they will make the world a better place in ways that their father completely has failed to do.
Don't do yourself down, Russell. Thank you so much. I could go on for ages, but I've realised we've gone on for over an hour. This has been great. Much appreciated.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it, Ian. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's great to talk to someone who's so into sort of innovative thinking and innovative ideas and studying how we can improve our cities. It's great to talk to you.
We'll keep chipping away. I love you people that stay all the way to the end of our podcasts. Fantastic. Showed you liked it, I think. And if you did like it, click like, click share, send it to somebody, message us, tell us what you liked and who you'd like us to interview next. We're always open to recommendations and ideas. Yeah, this podcast made by my work that I do with Now and Ever, basically doing research and innovation and creative stuff. And I really care about doing more things that impact cities. So yeah, there we are. Thanks so much. Speak to you soon. Bye.